Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. In a report released October 12th, the Labor Department reported that 4.3 million Americans quit their jobs in August. And that's the highest number since December of 2000. This is the Great Resignation. But not all sectors of the economy are losing employees equally. Restaurants, bars, and hotels are shedding workers at a particularly high rate. About one in five of those who resigned in August walked out of hospitality sector jobs. Some weighed their options and departed for higher paying gigs, while others left the industry entirely after serving through the gauntlet of COVID. Many restaurant owners and operators are feeling the effects of the resulting worker shortage.
My name is Gregory Leon, and I'm the chef and owner of Amalinda, a small, independently owned Spanish and Portuguese-inspired restaurant in downtown Milwaukee.
Chef Leon told us that due to staffing challenges, he's been unable to restore pre-pandemic hours of operation.
The worker shortage is killing us. I'm currently the only one in the kitchen. So I come in, do all the desserts, and then prep all three stations. And then I've been lucky enough that some of my colleagues and friends have been able to come in and step in on Fridays and Saturdays and help cook with me on the line. There's a smaller pool of people looking for jobs. There's a smaller pool of employees for us to bring into the restaurant. And not only are we dealing with that, but we're also competing with restaurants who did receive the RRF. And so these restaurants who have received the RRF, they're able to pay their employees $17, $18, $20 an hour, where I cannot afford that right now based on business.
The Restaurant Revitalization Fund, or RRF, gave out grants to eligible food businesses during the pandemic. But the funding was not enough. 85% of restaurant and bar applicants were unable to secure a grant, meaning restaurant owners like Gregory are left with little outside help and plenty of stress.
Well, my hair is a lot grayer now, and it's probably falling out at a faster rate than it was before pre-COVID. We've had to modify our menu, so our menu is a lot smaller right now than it normally would be. We've had to simplify some of our dishes just because, you know, there's only so much one person can prep in a day, especially when they're prepping one station. And our guests, it's affecting our guests' experience. You know, they're having to wait a little bit longer for their food. And then you run the risk of upsetting the guests and then having the guests not come back. And it's stressful on the other staff members, you know, the front of the house staff.
And this is not just a problem in Wisconsin. Times are tough in neighboring Chicago as well.
I'm Marcos Carvajal, co-owner and president of Carnitas Uruapan Restaurants in Chicago.
Carnitas Uruapan describes themselves as distinctly and unapologetically Mexican. Visit the website, and right next to the expected buttons for menu, catering, and locations is a link to submit your application to work at the restaurant.
We've been fortunate that we were able to retain a lot of longtime staff, albeit, you know, working with reduced hours and, you know, really not 100% back to pre-pandemic levels. But I have noticed that the vacancies that we have had have taken an extremely long time to fill. You know, pre-pandemic, I would put in a job ad and usually be able to find someone, you know, pretty well qualified for a position within 5 days. The last position that I filled took me well over a month to find someone. And, you know, it's never really been that bad. It's really tough to compete as a small independent restaurant, you know, with some of the bigger employers out there that are, you know, offering higher and higher starting salaries for, you know, this essentially the same labor pool.
And even for restaurants not struggling with staffing issues, many other challenges remain due to the pandemic.
My name is Susanna Cotine, and I'm the owner of both Lido and Bixie that are on Frederick Douglass Boulevard in Harlem in Manhattan.
Susanna told us that she's had to deal with a lot of COVID-related red tape with city officials.
We've been able to get by on our staff. Sometimes it's a little tight, but we've been lucky that a lot of our people came back when, you know, we were open full swing. You know, New York City continues to be really, really difficult. to have a small business in, and the amount of inspectors that come in and just a surprise visit. And I just had somebody come in the other day. I was literally in a meeting with a bank regarding a loan, and somebody came in and handed me a paper that said I had to take my outside houses down from the Department of Transportation. And it was just such a shock and devastating, because we spent a ton of money on that. And that's a huge, you know, source of revenue for us right now. And, you know, we're still trying to dig out of a hole from the pandemic.
And it's not just the restaurants and their owners who are struggling. Workers in the food service industry face long hours, late nights, and sometimes low pay, minimal benefits, and hostility from customers and even from managers. In a May 2021 survey from One Fair Wage and the UC Berkeley Food Labor Research Center, a majority of restaurant workers said they're leaving due to low wages and tips. The next highest ranked reasons people left their restaurant jobs were COVID health risks and concerns of hostility or harassment. And when we put out the question to you out there about whether restaurant worker shortages are affecting you, here's what some of you had to say.
Hey, it's Mark Hooper calling from Little Rock, Arkansas. And yeah, the worker shortage has affected me, but not in the way that you would expect it to. I contributed to the worker shortage. Pandemic hit, and I got out of the restaurant bar business. I used to be a bar manager and a bartender, and I walked away from it. I knew that my state wasn't going to do anything to help support bartenders or restaurants during the pandemic. I was right. And now I work for the United States Post Office.
Hi, my name is Doran O'Donnell, and I live in Grants Pass, Oregon. I own a small restaurant bar called The Speakeasy, and we have had a hard time keeping employees, and there have been many times where we've had to shut down because we didn't have the people to work.
Hi, my name is Rachel Wilson, and I own Giggle Waters in Safety Harbor, Florida. We've really bounced back from a volume perspective since the shutdown. I mean, the lines are out the door. People are ready to go out. They want to have a fun night out. They're there to support us. But staffing is a bear right now. I've never seen anything like it. We've certainly increased our wages. We're doing all we can to attract the right people. I'm posting everywhere for job fairs. We maybe get one or two people who show up for interviews, and then hopefully one of them will actually come in and start. We used to go into a Saturday night with 10 servers on. Now we'll go in with maybe four sometimes.
Now, even as we hear those voices of the restaurant industry, it's critical to understand the ways COVID exacerbated issues already plaguing restaurant workers for decades. The policy of a sub-minimum wage for tipped workers means many servers earn as little as $2.13 per hour before tips. And because servers rely on tips in an industry that's not required to provide for a living wage, many workers find themselves enduring astonishing levels of harassment. Saru Jayaraman is president of One Fair Wage and director of the Food Labor Research Center at the University of California, Berkeley, and is author of One Fair Wage, Ending Subminimum Pay in America. Saru, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
So talk to me here. As you listen to our restaurant workers and restaurant owners, what are kind of your initial responses?
Well, I would say the majority of the voices we heard were owners. We heard from one worker and mostly owners. And that has been sort of the, you know, I think during the pandemic, mostly we are hearing from owners talking about their struggles. And I think it's really important to lift up workers and exactly what you said, Melissa, that they have been struggling with a crisis in this industry long before the pandemic. I think owners definitely struggled during the pandemic. I would say the struggles of workers were crisis level before the pandemic, and with the pandemic, people lost their homes, lost their, you know, ability to feed their children. I mean, the struggle and crisis got so much worse. But listen, during the before the pandemic, as you said, we had this direct legacy of slavery in our industry. You know, at emancipation, the restaurant lobby wanted the ability to hire newly freed slaves, not pay them anything, and have them live entirely on tips. And so they created this very unique system in America. We're the only country that does it, allowing restaurants to pay little or nothing and having workers live on tips. And so we went from $0 at emancipation as an attempt to hire Black people for free, all the way up to the ridiculous $2.13 an hour today. And even before the pandemic, you're talking about an overwhelmingly population of women struggling with the highest rates of sexual harassment and poverty of almost any industry in the US. Well, with the pandemic, these workers, first, many of them were not able to access unemployment insurance. Two-thirds of the workers we surveyed, and we surveyed 250,000 workers after the pandemic shutdown, two-thirds told us they couldn't get unemployment insurance because in most states they were told their wages were too low to qualify for benefits. And when they did go back, they found that tips had gone way down because sales were down and harassment and hostility had gone way up. And I could say a lot more about that, but that combination really became, frankly, life-threatening. And you saw mass exodus last year itself.
Saru, before we get to the question of the harassment, can you explain just one tick more on the unemployment insurance issue?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it was really a moment of epiphany for so many workers, because when you get a wage of $2 or $3 an hour, as it is in 43 states, including blue states like New York and Illinois and Massachusetts, have a subminimum wage that's a direct legacy of slavery. So you're talking about, anywhere from $2 to $5 in most states. New York, the wage is 66% of the wage, all a direct legacy of slavery. Well, these workers, you know, they lived most of their income. The vast majority of their income was from tips. That small wage, that subminimum wage, was so low, it often went entirely to taxes and they were living off their tips. And when they went to go apply for unemployment insurance, most states told them, it looks like you earned too little to qualify for benefits. It looks like you didn't work enough hours. So at the start of the pandemic, you know, when the pandemic shutdown occurred, about 6 million restaurant workers lost their jobs. That's one in four Americans who lost their jobs was in the restaurant industry when the pandemic shut down the economy last March. And we heard from so many workers. One was a woman named Sarah May from Michigan, worked in a small dive bar in a small town in Michigan, and told us that she had religiously reported her tips to the IRS. The wage in Michigan is $3.52 an hour. But when she went to apply for unemployment insurance, she was told that her employer never reported her tips. And it looked like she had just earned that $3 wage. And so in total, it looked to the state of Michigan that she had not actually worked in full time. She had not worked enough hours to qualify for benefits. So she couldn't get state unemployment insurance. Then when federal unemployment insurance came out, it was supposedly not based on your income. It was supposed to be just on loss of a job. She was told she'd be eligible for that, but because it came through the state of Michigan system and she was marked as a denial by the state of Michigan, she was never able to access those funds. And so this is the incredible, outrageous irony of the moment. Here you have some people claiming, oh, these workers are lazy, staying home, collecting unemployment insurance, when the truth is a huge majority of these workers never received it or received very little because their wages were so low. And it was at that moment, that was the beginning of the exodus. We heard from so many workers at that moment last spring, wait a second, if the government is telling me I earn too little to qualify for benefits like everybody else who's been working full-time or more than full-time, then probably I earn too little if the state is telling me that. And I should never have put up with this subminimum wage to begin with. And so when we did the survey you mentioned this May, surveying 3,000 workers and, you know, 54% of those who remain in the industry, and mind you, so many left last year, but this year, 54%, more than half of those who remain in the industry say they're leaving. And 78%, nearly 8 in 10, say the primary thing that's going to make them stay in the industry or come back to work in restaurants is a full minimum wage with tips on top. So there has been this just moment of epiphany. Wait a second. If everybody's saying I earn too little, the government is saying I earn too little to get benefits. And then on top of that, you want me now to enforce social distancing and mask rules and COVID vaccination card rules on the same customers from whom I'm supposed to get tips to make up my income. But even with those tips, I'll never be considered earning enough to actually qualify for benefits for everybody else. Honestly, I'm done and you can take this job and shove it.
All right. Talk to me, expand on that aspect that is the requirement of front of the house workers to enforce the masking rules. What is masculine harassment?
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, it's important to note that our industry had the highest rates of sexual harassment of any industry in the United States prior to the pandemic. We worked closely with Professor Catherine McKinnon, who's many people know, legendary law professor who really coined the term sexual harassment and spent her life trying to make it illegal in the United States. And she did research with us, and she, in her words, the rate of sexual harassment in our industry among tipped workers dwarfs all other sectors, including the military, because you have this overwhelmingly, this workforce of, that is overwhelmingly women that must tolerate inappropriate customer behavior to feed their families in tips. And the connection to the tip minimum wage is very clear when you look at the seven states that got rid of the sub-minimum wage many decades ago. California, Oregon, Washington, Nevada, Minnesota, Montana, and Alaska require full minimum wage with tips on top, have for decades, not only have higher small business growth rates, lost fewer restaurants during the pandemic, but also have one half the rate of sexual harassment in the industry because their women can count on a wage from their boss like every other worker in every other industry. They don't have to put up with as much from male customers. They're not as dependent on the tip. And it was that power dynamic between women servers and male customers that got so much worse with the pandemic, because with tips way down, because sales are down, and now this added responsibility to tell customers, put on a mask, sit 6 feet apart, now I need to see your COVID vaccination card. You know, the power dynamic of I need to get tips from these very same people resulted in really a very ugly situation in which we heard from thousands of women. I am repeatedly asked on every shift by male customers, take off your mask so I can see how cute you are before I decide how much to tip you. Take off your mask so I can see the pretty face of my server before I decide how much to tip. And what was truly intolerable in the past, you know, outrageous, humiliating, now became a matter of life and death. And so naturally, many people said, that's it, I'm done. You are asking me to expose myself and my children and my family to the virus for the opportunity, for the chance at earning an income when I can go work in another industry and at least get the minimum wage or more from my employer without having to expose myself in this way for the chance to get a tip.
In our last moments here, what is the Raise the Wage Act?
Yeah, so there, I think what's incredible about this moment, the silver lining about this moment is that we are seeing this, we're calling it a wage shortage, not a worker shortage. There are workers, they just won't work for these wages. This resulting in thousands of restaurants now raising their wages across the country. And this needs to be driving policy. The federal Raise the Wage Act needs to follow employers who are paying this and saying we can't do it alone. In New York State, Governor Hochul is, you know, can move in this direction and the sub-minimum wage for tipped workers. Multiple states are looking at this. This is the time to support workers who are saying we can't come back without this, and small business restaurants who are saying we're paying these wages, but we're raising wages, but we need the government to make this a level playing field and signal to workers it is worth coming back to work in restaurants.
Saru Jayaraman is the president of One Fair Wage and director of the Food Labor Research Center at the University of California, Berkeley. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's been years in the making, but faculty at the University of Pittsburgh have voted overwhelmingly to form a union, making it the country's largest new faculty union assembled in a decade. Now, the process started in 2015, and in the years since, faculty at Pitt have been met with opposition from school leadership, which included paying an anti-union law firm $2 million since efforts to unionize first started. But after allying with the United Steelworkers, North America's largest industrial union with more than a million members, the faculty union effort passed a vote last week. Now, more than 3,300 people are part of its collective bargaining unit. To find out more about how this unionization came into being, I spoke with Paul E. Johnson, assistant professor of communication at University of Pittsburgh and a member of the union organizing committee.
It's really a very long process. It's even longer than 6 years in some ways because there have been efforts to organize the university going back to the 1970s and the 1990s. And those previous efforts really had informed the efforts of faculty here who got together back in 2015 and started to talk about some of the things that they were upset about in the workplace. Salaries for, faculty at a world-class university, especially for lecturers and adjuncts, weren't really keeping up with our peers. The reliance on adjuncts and the sort of over-reliance on that precarious working class was something else that really had worried people. And even the things that people, liked about the job here, for example, some of our benefits, there were worries that those might not be permanent if, there ever came a time for further austerity. So faculty started having conversations with one another about what they could do. And, there were some folks around who'd been part of those efforts in the 1990s. And, they talked a little bit with them about what happened and, what some of the roadblocks then had been and what some of the opportunities were in the present. And conversations kind of went from there. And they went from conversations from, some faculty to between a whole lot of the faculty as we started to canvas and talk to our colleagues and understand their concerns and figure out, whether or not a union would be right for the faculty at Pitt. And the same thing informed our process of thinking about who we wanted to associate ourselves with as a faculty, because there's a lot of options for that as well. So it was a whole lot of conversations that took a whole lot of time, and it's really been decades in the making.
All right. So I want to sort of dive into some of these pieces that you've begun to lay out here, and especially for folks who, for them, maybe the idea of college faculty sounds like, why in the world would you need labor protections? Don't you guys just teach a couple times a week, smoke pipes, have patches on your arms, or on the, basically on your tweed jackets, right? Like, I think for folks, for many people, even to say the language of faculty may not clarify all the different kinds of roles and different levels of security that folks have. So can you maybe walk us through some of those aspects?
Absolutely. Yeah. So we've got our faculty union here at Pitt is all ranks, which is one way to organize a faculty union. And what that means is you've got all of these different sort of job classifications that exist in the university system. And I'll talk a little bit about each of those. You have adjuncts who are typically hired sort of on a kind of an a la carte basis just to teach classes. So that means that they're often teaching not just at one institution, but to make ends meet, they might be teaching at three or four institutions. I know we have faculty at Pitt, for example, who also teach classes at Robert Morris, Point Park, Duquesne, and some of the other universities in the area. And so those folks are likely being, paid a few thousand dollars per class. And they're hustling around the whole city maybe in a single day to be on three, four different campuses. They don't usually have office space that's dedicated for them. And they are also considered in the university's system for designation, more or less temporary employees. So their IDs expire every 4 months. And at Pitt, your ID gets you free access to the bus. So, that's a huge, huge issue. So that's one group of folks. And then you have lecturers whose jobs are focused primarily on teaching. But everybody who's not an adjunct usually has a lot of service obligations. At Pitt, our lecturers teach three classes a semester. They often advise undergraduate students. They often mentor these students. They have office hours and work closely with these students. They also have a lot of service obligations in terms of developing curriculum. They have responsibilities for attending faculty meetings, sometimes for being part of internal governance mechanisms at the university. At Pitt, they've also, if you're a lecturer at Pitt, you are among the worst paid people in your class at cognate universities in the United States. So they're really busy, very busy. And then you have tenured and tenure stream faculty. And to the extent that there's some, a kernel of truth in the smoking jacket stereotype, these are the people that are imagined as doing that work, right? Research faculty. But in practice, research faculty are also extraordinarily busy. They have tons of service obligations and research obligations and teaching obligations. If you're not yet tenured, then you're often being judged on the quality of your research and teaching. And so you've got to be and your service. So you're working overtime on all three of those things to make sure that you've got a sterling record when you come up for tenure. And of course, you know, the competition in academia, like in most areas of our society, has only gotten more intense. So you're expected now to produce way more research than you would have been 20 years ago, 30 years ago, or 40 years ago. And if you're a tenured faculty member, then you're still required to research to be promoted, right, from associate professor to full professor, and you have a lot of service obligations. So very often, as soon as you're out of the fire of, draining research intensity, you find yourself placed on, right, dozens of committees for graduate students, for university service, for disciplinary service. So it's, a 60-hour a week job the whole time through, rather than, a lot of time spent at the university club with some of the finest scotches of the world.
Yeah, I think there may have been some kind of time in the American Academy when that was partly true, but it is certainly not the experience of the American Academy now. And I'll just add, one more piece is often also for tenure and tenure stream faculty, those responsibilities of grant writing and of obtaining external funding, especially depending on sort of where you are in the natural and social sciences and humanities and professional schools. Okay. So your union is not only representative of all faculty across all of the Pitt campuses, but is also affiliated with the United Steelworkers. Help us understand that.
Yeah, it's really been fascinating. That's one of the things that's interested the people the most about the campaign. And for us, it seemed like kind of a natural decision because, they're in the Allegheny County region and the surrounding region. They've long represented people. They've also got recent experience working with folks in academic units. They've, been a part of faculty who organized at Robert Morris and Point Park, which are both universities in the area. And they also work with some workers in the academic sector up in Toronto, actually. So they're not just, this sort of blue collar producerist image, right, of the hardworking steel man. They've always represented actually kind of a lot of, or for a long time represented a lot of different sectors of the economy. And for a lot of the people on faculty, as we were talking about, well, what do we want to see in a union? What do we need? We were impressed by the USW's history of advocating for its workers, achieving strong contracts, and having their workers back when serious disputes came up. And the fact that it was in Pittsburgh, made it in some ways all the more resonant because we were thinking about, well, what does labor look like in the United States? And there's a lot of stereotypes about, what is real work, what is real labor. But the idea that, the University of Pittsburgh faculty could be affiliated with steelworkers, in some way you put those two things together. And if that's what we're doing, then, a steelworker doesn't just mean what, people think it means in one sense. And faculty doesn't just mean what faculty, means to some people in another sense, right? We have, a faculty that are affiliated with the steelworkers, and that means that we get to bargain, negotiate, and behave as such. So it's really kind of about the legacies of the Steel City and also what that legacy is going to look like into the future and how you can't necessarily project things just from the past.
Now you talked a bit about the long road to unionization. Typically, a road might not be that long to a union process. Did you all meet with resistance?
There were some difficulties. I mean, I'll say up front, we're very excited to be, on the brink of negotiating with the administration like partners. And we know while it was a really tough fight, there's a sense that it's time to move forward and work together for a better university for faculty, students, staff, administrators, really everybody. But we did have some roadblocks. During the organizing phase in a union effort, you have to basically prove that there's interest from the faculty to have a a union, and that requires basically what's called a card drop, where you go around and faculty member are offered cards to sign just to say, I'd be interested in a union, right? Not even necessarily, you know, hey, I think we should have a union, it should be this union, but we're going to have a vote and we're going to figure out whether or not we want to be a unionized faculty. And so we dropped those cards in January of 2017, when we'd already been organizing for a couple years. And, you know, that basically that card drop, you have a year from when the cards go to when the cards are tabulated. And so at the end of that, when we got to the tabulation point, there, the administration and us had a dispute over whether or not we'd hit our 30% threshold, which is the threshold required to say that you've showed cause for an election. And each side submits names. And, you know, the Pennsylvania Labor Review Board eventually evaluated the names and made a ruling. And they found that the university's list had a bunch of people on it who hadn't worked at Pitt in a really long time or had done things for Pitt, but hadn't necessarily been paid for those things, or more like volunteers. And so they found actually that we did clear that 30% threshold and could have an election. So that was a difficulty. And then we also had some issues over the composition of the bargaining unit and its size, with some 11th hour actions as an election was about to be called over who would be members of that. And again, the PLRB sort of found in our favor on those questions and decided that we could go ahead with the unit that we had proposed and that eventually voted 71% in favor of unionization.
Now, let's go back to something that you said in the process of unionizing and the entire process of organizing. One of the questions you said was, you know, so what kind of union do we want to be and what do we want? So let me ask, what is it you want? What is it you need?
Well, it's a great question, and it's one that we're sort of always in the process of answering, in part because now that we're moving into the bargaining phase, you know, we have to start to have more conversations with folks who during the campaign had either been very aggressively neutral on the question of unionization or even opposed to the question of unionization. But they're a part of this unit too. And so we are having ongoing, right, conversations with them about their view of the university, their view of their job, what they need to do their jobs better, and, you know, what we all need to do our jobs better. But, you know, I think in terms of things that folks have been talking about, you know, we're looking at lots of things that need to improve here at the university. I know during the pandemic, you know, concerns over kinship and childcare had gone from, you know, something that was already a problem to a huge issue. Folks are concerned that we're having costs for our healthcare increase that are not being matched by the raises that we're receiving. So, you know, locking in the benefits that the university that we have that are good, and also thinking about the ways that we can compensate folks and put them in a more comfortable position so that they're not having anxiety on the day to day about, you know, whether, you know, about their job, whether or not they're going to be renewed next semester, whether or not they're going to, you know, be able to make ends meet, and instead let them focus on their world-class task of teachers, you know, researchers. Pitt's a place where there's a lot of really cutting edge scientific and medical developments that are taking place. Like, we want everybody to be able to focus on those parts of their jobs and not worry so much about the right compensation and benefit side of the equation.
Last question has to do with the COVID-19 moment. It has been a bit of maybe an awakening, certainly not yet a reckoning, but an awakening in American higher ed around at least the theory of faculty governance of universities versus a reality in the context of the COVID-19 crisis, and particularly when it very first hit in the spring of 2020, and the speed with which many university administrators were able to make a wide range of budgetary and even structural decisions about their campuses because of the nature of the crisis. And so I think there's been, and feel free to push back on this, but there's been a bit of an awakening around, wait a minute, are faculty actually governing their universities? And I'm wondering if that has been raised in conversations at Pitt, and if so, how you might see unionizing as being part of the kind of broader faculty governance question.
Absolutely. I mean, from the start of the campaign, you know, as we had thousands of conversations with colleagues, workplace democracy, transparency, i.e. why is the administration making certain decisions that they're making, and shared governance were all really important values that popped up in these conversations. And COVID, I think, really underscored and amplified those as concerns because, you know, there were certainly, right, lots of channels, right, through which faculty could make their opinions and perspectives known to the administration. And yet the decisions that were being made by the administration very often seemed, you know, to be at odds with a lot of what faculty were saying. And, you know, obviously COVID put everybody in a very difficult situation. But I think that there was a sense that shared governance needed to have a little more in the way of teeth. And, you know, there needed to be even more substance to our position as faculty and being able to make our voices heard, and, you know, receiving even just earlier guidance and clarity about questions like, you know, masks in the classroom, is there going to be a vaccination mandate? You know, if there is, what are the reasons for that? If there isn't, what are the reasons for that? You know, relying on the guidance that is given from, right, Pitt has world-class School of Public Health. So, you know, how's the university incorporating and responding to that kind of advice that, you know, is being given on the ground from experts? And people were in the dark about a lot of that process, and why decisions were being made. So, you know, there is, I think certainly, right, both broadly and here, has been this notion that, you know, universities are places that are dedicated to the study of democracy, that are interested in furthering knowledge and, you know, furthering the development of a civic arena where people's claims are listened to and taken really seriously. And, you know, unionization is a path that will help ensure that, you know, the claims of the faculty, workers, and people, right, need to be taken seriously by those institutions.
Paul E. Johnson is an assistant professor at the University of Pittsburgh and a member of the Union Organizing Committee. Professor Johnson, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Melissa.
And we, of course, are on the precipice of Halloween. Ghosts, ghouls, creepy crawly things that go bump in the night. And no, we're not talking about partisan gridlock on Capitol Hill. We are going to the movies.
Have you heard about this videotape that kills you when you watch it?
Look behind you.
Red Rum! Red Rum!
Oh, just some scary movie.
Michael?
Why, she wouldn't even harm a fly.
They're here. Whew! If you're like me, then you're feeling the shivers up and down your spine right about now. And other than trick-or-treating, nothing says Halloween quite like settling in for a scary movie. If you're a horror movie fan, you've probably already seen this year's biggest releases, like the latest entry in the Halloween movie franchise and the reboot of
Candyman.
Hey, I didn't say it. But if you're looking for some new frights, you've come to the right place. I have two guests with me now to make sure you're properly creeped out this Halloween. Kristen Meinzer is a culture critic and author of How to Be Fine, and Rafer Guzman is film critic for Newsday. Together, they co-host Movie Therapy Podcast. It is great to have you both here.
Thanks so much for having us back.
All right, so to both of you, what is it that you look for in a scary movie?
Me personally, I want to feel all sorts of feelings, the feelings of, you know, shivers running up and down my spine. I want to be jumping out of my seat, but I also sometimes want a little bit of a surprise of other feelings too, whether that's laughter, whether it's feeling something deep in my heart that's touching. A horror movie that gives me additional feelings and gives me more to think about always makes me a little bit more impressed with the movie and makes me think about it afterward.
How about you, Rafer?
Well, I guess it kind of depends. I think there are kind of two types of horror movies. There are the really fun ones where you're kind of jumping out of your seat and things are going boo and it's, you know, ghosts. And there's always that scene where the, you know, the camera sort of zooms in close on the hero and then suddenly someone appears next to them and, you know, they jump with fright and then you all jump with fright. So there are these kind of feel good horror movies, I think, that are a lot of fun. Then I think there are these kind of feel bad horror movies that are sort of not for a good time, that are really truly upsetting and traumatizing and ghastly. And I love those too. So I think it kind of depends on what I'm in the mood for.
All right. I really feel like we should talk about your interest in this kind of desire to feel bad. But Kristen, I just want to say, like, I have a big sister who, I mean, she's not going to get on a roller coaster and she is not going to any movie that she knows is a scary movie. What do you say to people like my big sister? Can I manage to drag her out to one this year?
Yes, you can. I mean, well, don't drag her out. Watch one at home because I have a list of movies, and I would say 2 out of 3 of my movies you can watch if you don't fancy yourself a horror movie fan. There are some chills, but there's also a lot to think about, and you might feel other things, surprising feelings, feelings about how you process pain or things about how, you know, America's consumerist machine works or whatnot. So
that is terrifying.
It is scary, yes. These are scary things, dealing with our own internal demons and dealing with the greater American, you know, machinations of consumerism and so on. But I do think that these kinds of movies, they can kind of please a lot of people. They can please the people who want a little bit of a scare, and they can please the people who don't want too much of a scare and want to think a little bit more.
Now, Raver, I'm wondering, since you're down for the feel good bad, the, you know, the feel good horror movies and the feel bad horror movies, are there bad horror movies there? Are there some that are just too cliche for you?
Yeah, I mean, that would be most of them, I think. You know, they really tend to kind of hit on the same old tropes, the same old formula. It's always the angry Native American spirit, or the spirit that belongs to some kind of tribe or society or ancient religious sect you've never heard of, and it wants a soul, and of course you have to give it something, and there's always the expert who that you have to go to, and he opens up the giant leather book and blows the dust off it and reads you the instructions of how to do it. It all gets a little tiresome, I think. I really do like it when a horror movie can find something new or do something new with the old formulas, which work. They work for a reason, but I think it's a horror movie's job to kind of freshen things up a little bit.
Hmm. Now, Kristen, we did ask both of you about your favorite underseen Halloween movies. And, well, I was listening to some of these this morning. So Kristen, let's start with your first pick, Eyes Without a Face, the French film from 1959. Listen.
De son visage.
Edna, elle s'est échappée.
All right, given that it's in French, can you help us understand what's going on with this film, Kristen?
Yes. So this is, as you said, a little bit of an older film. It's about 50 years old now. But even though it's a classic, I know very few people who have ever seen it, including my fellow film critics. So this is an underseen film, in my opinion. It centers on a renowned plastic surgeon in France, whose specialty is transferring living tissue from one living person to another. Now, after destroying his daughter's face in a reckless car accident, he is racked with guilt and begins kidnapping young women who resemble her with the hopes of transplanting their living faces onto hers. Of course, nothing ever goes quite as planned. And I just want to note here, it sounds like it's a really gory movie, but it's actually not. It's more than anything kind of a strange poetic meditation on what we all do with our own guilt and how we process other people's guilt. So I think it's a great Halloween movie for your sister, Melissa. It's a great Halloween movie for anybody who wants something a little bit more beautiful, a little bit more surprising. As Rafer was saying, you know, you watch this movie and it doesn't necessarily go the places you think it's going to go. And it's just pretty to look at, too.
So, Rafer, let's start with your first suggestion. It's a movie called Phantasm, which you recently watched with your 11-year-old son.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite movies. You know, it's from 1979. I always love this movie. It's a movie about a kid named Mike, and his parents have died recently, and now other people in his town seem to be dying mysteriously too. And the kid thinks it has something to do with the Morningside Cemetery. And so he goes poking around the funeral home after dark, and he discovers all these weird things that you kind of wouldn't expect, even if you were to go poking around a haunted cemetery. First of all, the place turns out to be staffed by these dwarf zombies that seem to come from another planet. And the hallways are patrolled by this flying silver orb that, if it catches you, will stick razor blades into your skull and then drill your brains out and spill all your brains all over the floor. So, of course, little Mike has to figure out a way to get everyone else to believe that there's something weird going on Morningside Cemetery. And yes, I did show it to my 11-year-old, and he just loved it. He thought it was the funniest thing.
Apparently the apple tree, not far. I got it. All right.
I agree.
So, Kristen, your next pick is a horror comedy from 1985. And it's just, okay, taking the weirdness with me for a moment.
When I was a little girl, I didn't think there was anything that I liked better than ice cream. Now I'm a big girl, and I've decided there's something I like better. Much better. It's called the stuff. And believe me, enough is never enough.
All right, can we talk about this? The Stuff, directed by Larry Cohen. And apparently you first watched it as a kid?
The Stuff, oh my gosh. I love this movie. I watched this as a little kid. I could handle this movie, even though I could not handle horror movies at that time. The Stuff begins when a gooey white substance resembling ice cream is discovered by railroad workers. They find it to be sweet and addictive, and before you know it, this alien substance is being marketed and distributed as a zero-calorie dessert to a diet and sweets-obsessed America. Not to be one-upped by this new product, the leaders of the suffering ice cream industry hire an undercover detective to find out what the stuff is actually made of, and they soon discover the stuff is actually a living, parasitic, and possibly sentient organism that gradually takes over the brain, eating people from the inside out. And I just got to say, it is a hilarious, clever movie that, you know, even though it's from 1985, it's still very smart. It's still very on point. And it still says a lot about America's obsession with consumerism and weight loss. So I just think it's worth seeing. And the commercial spots, they have all these commercials that run through the movie for the stuff, which will just make you laugh and think, oh, that actually looks like a real TV commercial.
Okay, I so appreciate that. I am certainly old enough to remember 1985 very well, and particularly like the aerobics craze madness that was going on at the time. And that, okay, I appreciate that whole sort of idea of what's happening there. Rafer, I want to keep embracing the weirdness and get into the rock opera horror movie, Phantom of the Paradise.
Dream each other's smile.
Filters.
Like a child who was always poor, reaching out for more, I can feel the hunger growing.
All right, so that sounds pretty different than your typical horror movie.
Yeah, well, see, Melissa, I tried to pick some feel-good horror movies for this. This is like a kind of a horror musical glam rock comedy, which I know sounds like Rocky Horror, but this actually came out the year before. And it's basically like a version of, like a glam rock version of Faust. You've got this singer-songwriter named Winslow Leach who wants to break into the music industry. And of course, he winds up selling his soul to the devil. And there's a little bit of Phantom of the Opera mixed in there. Couple of great things about this movie. It's directed by Brian De Palma, who I love. You've got all these great, weird 70s musical numbers that are clearly drawing from bands that were popular at the time, like Kiss and Meatloaf and Sha Na Na, but they're all sort of parodied and weirded up for the movie. And then Paul Williams, you know, the great singer-songwriter who wrote all the music for the film, he plays Satan, which I just think if you can picture Paul Williams for a minute, it's a hilarious image of Paul Williams playing Satan. And it's an early role for Jessica Harper, too. She plays the dream girl of the songwriter. But it's one of my favorite movies. It looks great. It's just really inventive and funny and creepy. And the music's great. And I've always loved this movie.
I can actually visualize that, and it is funny and also kind of horrifying. All right, Kristen, we're going to go into the kind of 21st century here a little bit with these final picks. Let's take a listen to the sound design on this really creepy one.
Just confess. Repent your sins. God's waiting.
sorry, that's The Lodge from 2019. Why should we be watching that one?
Well, I was so surprised this movie was not a bigger hit. It only grossed about $2 million worldwide, which, you know, in regular human terms is a lot of money, but in the movie industry, $2 million is next to nothing. It's pennies. So the chances are you haven't seen it, but you absolutely should. It begins when a writer named Richard informs his wife, Laura, that he's leaving her for a much, much, much younger woman named Grace. He met Grace while researching a book about an extremist cult, and Grace was actually raised in the cult, and she's the sole survivor of a mass suicide in the cult led by her late father. Now, in order for Richard's children to bond with Grace, he decides to take them all to a secluded lodge, and then he abandons all three of them at the lodge to get to know each other. And that's when things get really creepy. I thought I knew where this movie was going, but it had me jumping out of my seat, questioning my instincts. It was tense. It was claustrophobic. It will leave you guessing. It is such a scary, scary movie. So this is not for you and your sister, Melissa.
So it's funny you say that as we kind of close up here. But, you know, I couldn't watch horror movies last Halloween. I just couldn't do it. I felt like the pandemic felt too real to make anything like a horror movie feel even slightly good to me at the time. And, you know, obviously the podcast you co-host is called Movie Therapy. I'm feeling ready for the horror movies this year. Are horror movies a kind of therapy?
I mean, I think they are. I think they're very cathartic. I think they're a great way to put maybe a real fear at a bit of a distance, you know, disguise it as a demon or a spirit or a possessed child or something else. You know, you can kind of metaphorize these fears and then maybe deal with them a little better. I think they're great for it. I mean, listen, you got to have a stomach for it. Not everybody likes them, but I think they're a lot of fun. And when they're done well, they're great.
Rafer Guzman is a film critic for Newsday, and Kristen Meinzer is a culture critic and author of How to Be Fine. The two of them co-host Movie Therapy, the podcast. Kristen, Rafer, thank you so much.
Thanks for having us. This was so fun.
All right, y'all, that's all we have for you today. And as always, we appreciate you tuning in. If you missed anything or you want to listen back, check out our podcast. You can find us wherever you get your audio or head on over to thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. This is The Takeaway, and we're going to be back with you tomorrow.